So I will speak about this model that I worked on with these clever gentlemen here. And it can be seen as some version of abelian Euclidean gravity. And I want to talk about some aspects of the loop quantization, and hopefully by the end I can sketch for you this computation, which shows that the quantum constraint algebra closes off shell in a certain sense. So the main motivation, of course, is to understand better dynamics in LQG, because this is a famous open question. So I'll talk a little bit more in detail about that and how it relates to the constraint algebra and sort of the state of the art. And then I'll introduce this U1 cube model that we use to investigate some of the issues. And then we'll go back to the constraint algebra in a little more detail after we have some language to talk about it to see where the particular problems crop up that we think we can solve. I'll say a little bit briefly about some other toy models that give us some hints on how to proceed, and then a few details of this calculation, and that will be that. So, yeah, as most of us have probably seen several times, classically the constraints of GR generate this so-called hypersurface deformation algebra. So I don't think I need to explain the terms in it, but if I write something down that you don't recognize, do stop me. And this is really the link between 4D space-time covariance and the canonical theory. It's not specific to GR, and really we find it very important because it's the thing that tells you that after you've done this 3 plus 1 decomposition and broken manifest space-time covariance, that you're still dealing with generally covariant theory. So the philosophy behind what I'm going to talk about can basically be phrased this way, that representing this algebra via quantum operators is seen as a defining property to be satisfied by any canonical theory of quantum geometry and define some notion of what you might call quantum space-time covariance. So in particular, I would want to have some operator relation like this in the quantum theory. And more practically speaking, in terms of LQG, for instance, demanding a relation like this in some form can help us reduce some of the quantization ambiguities that might be present. So, yeah, a little more on this constraint algebra. What one might call the state of the art, given by Tiemann in these QSD papers. And what he does there is construct this Hamiltonian constraint subject to some reasonable criteria, such as 3D diffeomorphism covariance and some other more subjective criteria. But they all seem pretty reasonable. And there's been plenty of criticism raised about it. The one that we take most seriously is nicely written about by Nikolai and friends, and it's that this closure of the quantum constraint algebra is only checked on shell. So what that means is that, you know, we would want to check something like this in the quantum theory, but in this QSD series, what is checked is that the commutator of two Hamiltonians acting on a state which is diffeomorphism invariant vanishes. So it certainly makes sense because the would-be right-hand side, we think, should be proportional to diffeomorphism, but it's a little less strong than, say, a real operator relation. And yeah, indeed, as they point out in this review, in some well-understood models like bosonic string, you can get spurious results like different spectra and other things that I'm not as familiar with. So yeah, basically the take-home point is that on-shell closure of this kind is perhaps too weak of a criterion to determine if we've constructed a reasonable Hamiltonian constraint. So the criticism is strengthened a bit by Lewandowski and Morozov. They're able to enlarge this space of diffeomorphism invariant distributions that these guys live in and redo this calculation, and they still find that this vanishes. So it's kind of weird, because if we expect the right-hand side to be proportional to a diffeomorphism, and you have a state which isn't diffeomorphism invariant, you'd think you'd get something non-zero on the right-hand side. But it's not inconsistent, because you know, the would-be quantization of this operator actually gives zero if you do this computation. But that's still a little strange, because again, this guy is supposed to be built of a diffeomorphism generator and then some function of the triads or inverse metric. And so it might seem to be saying that the inverse metric is the zero operator, which is not very attractive. Okay, so now I'll talk about this model that I'm going to use to address this issue. So it was originally introduced by Smolin, and it can be seen as, yeah, if you start with Euclidean self-dual first-order action for gravity. So here you have just self-dual connection in Euclidean signature. This is what that looks like. And I just rescale the connection defining this A and take the coupling to zero. What it does really is just take the quadratic piece out of this curvature. And then I do a 3+1 decomposition. You come to this form of the action, which looks very similar to the one we see in gravity in these connection triad variables. So the configuration variable, again, is one form, and its conjugate momentum is some vector density, and the Hamiltonian is a sum of constraints. And yeah, so here are these constraints. Instead of having the SU2 Gauss law, you have three independent U1 Gauss law constraints. It doesn't depend on the connection. And diffeomorphism constraint has the same form. And the Hamiltonian is just the Euclidean Hamiltonian. But the curvature that appears is abelian now. And so then you can just check that the algebra of D and H, again, generates this hypersurface deformation algebra. So everybody with me so far? Any questions? OK.
So the inverse metric is built from the triads.
Sorry?
The inverse metric is built from the...
That's correct, yeah. EE over det Q. Or EE over Q. OK, so we can loop quantize this in the same way that it's done in loop quantum gravity. We have holonomies and fluxes. Right now, the holonomies are still labeled by an edge. But now the representation label is some integer, some U1 charge.
So can you go back? Where is the weak limit?
Sorry? Oh, the weak limit? The weak limit is I just take G to 0 after rescaling this connection. Yes, A is a U1 connection, three of them. OK. OK. So holonomies look like this. And similarly, similarly in LQG, I have fluxes where I smear this thing over some surface. And the basic states in the theory, I'll call charge networks because of these U1 charges instead of spin networks. And these are again labeled by graphs embedded in a spatial manifold. And each edge of the graph is colored by three of these charges.
Can you comment a bit on this thing? What does it mean? What does it correspond to?
Yeah, this is something I haven't thought about much, and it seems a little confusing, actually. When OG goes to 0, it usually seems like, I don't know, special relativity limit or something. But I don't have a good interpretation of it. And I invite anyone to offer one up to me. But yeah, it's not something I've thought about very much, but it's a good question.
Well, is there another way to understand this thing?
Not that I know of. We originally started looking.
Can you take such a limit in the metric formalism, or is it just available there?
Sorry?
Can you take such a limit in the metric formalism?
Oh, I am not sure. I suppose you could. I mean, at the level of the action, I mean, the limit can be taken at the level of the action. So if you just have, well, not just in metric formalism, but.
The scaling of a connection is a strange notion in imagination.
Yeah, I don't have a good answer for you. But I invite discussion about it. Are there any other questions? Yeah, originally when we started looking at this, we just said, okay, let's look at LQG, but replace the gauge group with U1. And then this Smolden limit is kind of something we stumbled upon later, and kind of makes it seem more physical, in a sense, or less ad hoc replacing it. And also, if you can get some nice handle on this theory, you could imagine looking at quantum gravity as a power series in G in this sense. Okay.
I was asking Lee once.
Yeah. Oh. Okay.
So what are the field equations?
The field equations?
Field equations, yeah. How do they change? I mean, normally you would get like Ricci equals zero. Right?
Sorry?
Ricci tensor equals zero would be your field equation, and now you have some different view.
You know, I don't know. I haven't looked at that either. That's a very sensible question.
What? The Hamiltonians are similar.
The Hamiltonians are the same, except the curvature is abelian.
Yes, so
I guess the equation.
Half the field equation.
Okay, that's right, yeah.
I mean, the equations usually are E, which F equals zero.
Yeah, right.
And then, I mean, I guess it's the same with the F being abelian.
Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of linearized,
Yeah, it's not quite linearized.
It's a bit different from linearized.
Well, it's actually the same limit as in Young-Mills. When you do perturbative Young-Mills, you rescale the connection exactly the same way, and then you do your perturbative Feynman expansion.
Yeah, except the weakly coupled theory here is nonlinear.
Yeah.
So, I don't know how to do perturbation theory.
In the SE2 case, I mean, you have this connection, but its curvature is essentially, you know, the Riemann tensor. I mean, you can't translate between the two because you have a triad and so on. So here it's not a priori obvious what the role of that curvature tensor is.
No. Yeah, that's a good question.
But,
more questions? Okay. Okay, so the set of all of these for all graphs and charges span this dense domain whose completion with respect to this Kronecker delta inner product is the kinematical Hilbert space of the theory. And gauge invariance is particularly simple. For each copy, right, these small I labels the commuting copies of U1. For each one of those separately and at each vertex of one of these graphs, the sum of the charges on the outgoing edges has to vanish. This corresponds to gauge invariance. And finite diffeomorphisms can be implemented the same way as in LQG. So I want to eventually motivate some definition of Hamiltonian constraint. Relatively similar to the one in Thomas's QSD. So I just want to review how you know, what is the, how quantizing local operators looks in general, or at least how it's understood in LQG. So if I have a phase-based function of these local fields, such as the Hamiltonian, right, first we approximate it in terms of the holonomies and fluxes with some regulating parameter, delta, just such that the limit when delta goes to zero gives me back this phase-based function. Then this thing I can quantize because the holonomies and fluxes are well-defined, but the local operators are not. And yeah, if it's well-defined on this dense domain, then I can compute its action on a given charge network here. And then the continuum limit taking delta to zero, generally you can't do it. So we have to have some other notion of continuum operator. And so usually what happens is consider the algebraic dual to this dense domain. Right? So every element of this is a linear map from the dense domain to complex numbers. And then for each pair, right, one guy from the dual and one guy from the dense domain, I could compute a one parameter family of complex numbers given by this inner product here, or matrix element, if you will. And then you define the continuum limit action of this operator as this limit here. And it really depends on the set of these size that you choose, whether this thing has a well-defined limit or a limit at all, or what the limit is. So for those of you familiar with this, this so-called uniform Rovelli-Smolin topology is given, right? That's the notion of continuum limit of operators in kind of this strange operator topology where I just look at matrix elements like this, where this state here is diffeomorphism invariant, right? So I choose a particular subset of these dual states, right, and define my operator continuum limit in terms of just those matrix elements. But you could choose other sets, and you would get different continuum limits, right? So we have this choice in principle. Any questions? Yeah. Okay. So I'd like to return to this constraint algebra and sketch really what we see or the things that can be tweaked about it. Okay, so if I look at the density one Hamiltonian, so in particular this thing features q to the minus 1/2. Q is the metric determinant. It's the same as the determinant of the triad. So this thing is some local functional or functional of local field, so I have to regularize it. And then kind of the straightforward choice and very similar to the one in QSD is to introduce some triangulation of the spatial manifold parameterized by some small parameter delta. And I replace this integral by a sum over plaquettes there. And then I just want to replace all of the fields in here with their corresponding regularized versions or things that are well defined on this Hilbert space. And okay, so for instance, right, the measure here, d3x, becomes delta cubed. Right, n is just a function, so I can evaluate it at some particular point of the plaquette. I can replace the curvature by this thing that usually gets used, the holonomy minus 1 divided by its area. Right, the triads get approximated by fluxes divided by the surface area. And then if you use one of these Tiemann-type tricks, you can regularize this thing, and you find out that it comes with a factor delta cubed. So the thing we should notice about this is that there are overall all the powers of delta cancel. Okay, so this is the reason that in principle, this limit can be taken. The delta goes to zero limit can be taken. You don't get any divergence from like a power of 1 over delta or something. So I can look at the action of the corresponding operator on some charge network. Right, so if I start with, okay, one feature of these is that they're usually local at the vertices. Right, so if I look near one vertex, right, this schematically what I get is these just multiply the state by some numbers, and this curvature, I get some arc coming here. I get a sum of terms like this where I add some arc, right? So then the thing to notice here is that these are all three valent vertices, and they're also the tangent space spanned by their tangents is planar. So these new vertices that get created, they're trivial in the sense that the volume vanishes there, and any Hamiltonian, I mean, if I act on this thing with another Hamiltonian, it's going to vanish at those points, so it won't act there again. Because eventually I want to do a commutator computation, so I have to have two of these things acting. So in particular, if I do act two of these operators, right, schematically I get something like this. I had one arc from the first Hamiltonian, and then I take a refinement of the triangulation and act this guy again. It doesn't act at these points. I just get some smaller arc here, plus other terms where the arc is in other places. And the important thing is that because it just acts at this vertex twice, I evaluate these lapse functions at the same point. Everybody all right? Okay. So now I want to see what I get from this commutator in the continuum. So normally, this is defined with respect to some distributions, as I was saying before. So here's an example of a diffeomorphism invariant distribution. I take some reference charge network, and then I just make a sum where I average, I look at the image of this charge network under every diffeomorphism. Right, there are some subtleties here with graph symmetries, but I'll ignore those for now. So in particular, you can just check that diffeomorphism acting on this guy doesn't do anything. So then this continuum commutator is defined with this, with these two limits here, right? I look at the action of one H, action of the other H, anti-symmetrize in the lapses, and then first take the delta prime limit, then take the delta limit. And this defines my left-hand side there. So as we saw in the previous slide, right, this thing is just proportional. It's the action of this on C is just proportional to the two lapses. And I get two arcs coming in some places. Right? I get a sum of terms like this. So this is a representative term in here. Now the point is, when I anti-symmetrize here, right, every term that appears when I acted the two H's the first time is going to appear again with N and M switched. But they may differ by a diffeomorphism. Right? I imagine I have two of these arcs sitting somewhere when I did the computation the first time. The second time I do it, in principle, they could be shifted somewhere. They don't have to be in the exact same place. But they do have to be diffeomorphically related. Right? So they differ only by a diffeomorphism. So I can write the whole commutator like this. Right? And because this is diff invariant, its eigenvalue is 1 when I act this way, so this thing just vanishes. Right?
Sorry.
Yes?
Could you explain again why, when you act for the second time priming with the second Hamiltonian, it doesn't act on the new vertices? You said those new vertices are trivial. Could you explain again why?
Yeah, because if you have a volume operator acting there, yeah, it's not obvious, really. It's obvious that the volume should vanish because, you know, it's some kind of a triple product. It involves some triple product of the tangents there, and these new vertices here are planar, so the volume vanishes. And then you actually have to do some work to show that, because in the Hamiltonian, normally you'll have a commutator between the volume and some holonomy, right? And then just because of the group theory involved there, you have some cancellations.
I guess that's the main reason why this now vanishes.
I didn't hear.
I just said that once you have that behavior, that the new vertices are trivial, this is just a pure consequence of that.
Yes. Okay, so now I want to sketch how this Lewandowski-Morov habitat comes into play and how you still get a trivial result, and this should give us some hints on how to fix it, basically. Okay, so they do basically the simplest thing you can do to make these states not diffeomorphism invariant, right? I'll construct some distribution in the same way that I'm constructing these diff invariant guys, but add some weights here that change when the vertices of this reference charge net move around. So I have some C prime, which has n vertices, and as the diffeomorphism drags this guy around, this function changes. So only when that function is constant do I get something that's diff invariant. So I can look at this computation again schematically and see that it still vanishes. Right, basically, okay, so this is an abbreviation of the picture I had on the last slide. I have when two H's act, I get some arcs near a vertex. And then again, I still get this diffeomorphism minus one and still these lapses outside. But now this thing doesn't have trivial action on this state, right? It moves. You can just it translates into composing with the function here. So you end up getting this, right? And this delta here on the diffeomorphism, right? You can imagine, right? If I have these two arcs that are moving around, and I needed this diffeo here to bring them onto each other, right? As I take delta to zero, and these arcs are getting closer and closer to the vertex, this diffeomorphism has to go towards the identity, right? So if this thing goes towards the identity, then I just have something minus something. So this vanishes again. Yeah, so you can imagine if there was some overall factor of 1 over delta sitting here, and I could conceivably get a derivative of this function as my result, but I'll never get the anti-symmetrized derivatives of these lapses. So I can maybe make the computation non-trivial, but then it will be anomalous, probably. Okay, so just a couple of brief comments. Yeah. Okay, so we want to take a couple of lessons from toy models plus the things that I just told you about how these constructions work to try and tune the construction that I want to show you. So one of the models where some of these ideas were tested is called parameterized field theory, and it's just a scalar field in flat Minkowski space in 1 plus 1 dimensions with compact space, but you have dynamical embeddings, so you kind of add diffeomorphism symmetry by hand, but you still have a theory that you kind of know the answers to. And there, it was seen explicitly that if you want to recover results that you know to be correct, then indeed you have to, this should not say lapse, you need to alter the density weight of the Hamiltonian operator that shows up, right? This manifests itself as giving me extra powers of this regulating parameter delta so that I can generate derivatives. So that's a must in this theory. And as a consequence, you're not going to be able to take the continuum limit of any of these operators on the analog of the kinematical Hilbert space there, right? You have to take the continuum limit on some space of distributions, because it would be singular on H-kin. The other one, which is even more illuminating, I think, is the diffeomorphism constraint in LQG. So there, the idea is to construct this generator on some space of states such that you get this operator relation holding off shell. And the strategy there was, or the successful strategy, right? You want to mimic what is what you think you're going to have to do for Hamiltonian constraint, which is define some regularized operator and take limit. All right, so I know what diffeomorphisms do. I know what finite diffeomorphisms do. So let's construct some regularized operator on this kinematical Hilbert space that does this, right? It's some finite diffeomorphism minus one, some finite but small parameterized by delta diffeomorphism minus one divided by delta. Right, so this thing looks like a derivative. And in fact, it guarantees that on this Lewandowski-Morelf habitat where I have these functions multiplying the states in the distribution, this relation is going to hold. And you kind of make it happen if you can make arguments that this operator can be constructed this way. Right, but then the problem is to do it. And what they found out is that, okay, you can do it, but you have to do something that hadn't been considered before, I think, in LQG, was to add these, right? You, instead of looking at the curvature operator as just trace of holonomy divided by area, right, I have to add some extra non-perturbative piece, right? This is proportional to 1/Planck length. And it's higher order in the regulating parameter, right? This E here is some flux, and it's proportional to delta squared. So this thing vanishes faster than this one as delta goes to zero. So in principle, I'm allowed to put it there if my only criterion is that as delta goes to zero, classically, I get F back. Okay. So this concludes all of the input that I want to use. So now I will tell you what we did. Are there any questions at this juncture? Okay, so the basic idea is the following. I want to quantize the Hamiltonian operator in this U1 theory. So I want to choose the density weight so that I get an overall factor of delta in the denominator of whatever action it's generating, so that I can, in principle, do the same thing that they do for diff constraint and have it have a continuum limit on some space of distributions that generates some derivatives of functions. And the other key input for diff constraint was to look for some geometric interpretation, right? You know what diffeomorphisms do, so I'm going to motivate the form of the operator that way. So I want to look for some geometric interpretation of H and ask that the finite triangulation operator mimic that action. And right, we're pretty confident that we can do this because of this example from diff constraint, that you have this freedom in adding these non-perturbative corrections that sort of have the same Hilbert space norm as the leading order approximant. And then, yeah, the remaining question is, how do we quantize the right-hand side, this diffeomorphism smeared with the metric-dependent shift, and then try and find some controllable set of distributions like Lewandowski-Morelf distributions so that I can take a continuum limit. Okay, so the density weight is not too hard to figure out if you want power 1/delta, because I have the... Right, I can choose any power of the metric determinant to put in the Hamiltonian constraint as long as I rescale the density weight of the lapse. Right, it doesn't change the algebra. So, right, you can just count these things up. Q to the minus alpha is like triad to the minus 3 alpha. And if I quantize these with fluxes, then this thing goes like regulating parameter 6 alpha. So I just add them all up, demand that I get 1 over delta, and I come with alpha to the 1/3. Yeah, so overall that gives me 1 over delta times some regular operator, which doesn't have any factors of delta in it. Everybody okay? Okay. And then, right, I should check what this choice of density weight does to the right-hand side. Yeah, so you can just compute this, compute the constraint algebra, see what happens on the left-hand side, and you get some q to the 1 minus 2 alpha, which goes like this power of delta. And for, right, the same choice, alpha equals 1/3, I get a 1 over delta. So this thing could, in principle, also generate diffeomorphisms, right, or generate derivatives, which would look something like Lie derivative. And then the other thing to note is that the usual choice is alpha equals 1/2. This is density 1. And if I stick that in here, I see that this approximate goes like delta to the positive 1. So, and you can see that it's not much of a surprise that this computation of Lewandowski and Morolf that shows that the right-hand side of the constraint algebra is also trivial is not surprising at all, because, right, this operator that I would quantize is some regular operator times delta. So when I take delta to 0, I just get 0. Okay. The geometric interpretation is also kind of straightforward. So if I define this object here, and I call NAI, it's this particular combination of triad, determinant, and the lapse. Because of the density weights, classically, this thing that I call electric shift is density weight 0 vector field. And then you can see what is the action of the Hamiltonian vector field on the connection. And it turns out you can write it in terms of a Lie derivative along this vector field, plus some piece that looks like a U1 gauge transformation. Yeah. And of course, it's not quite a diffeomorphism, right? Because this index is I, and this one's K. And you have some sum of them. So it's some weird thing, but we kind of want to force it into some geometric interpretation that we can work with. Okay, so this is the key thing that we're going to use. I want to take this infinitesimal action, translate it into some finite action on charge networks, and make that my finite triangulation Hamiltonian operator. Okay, so it can be done. And the result looks like this, right? If I start with some charge net with a vertex V, these dotted lines are the original charge net. And these new lines here are the deformations that this thing generates. All right, so I have schematically at a vertex V, the action gives me, I evaluate this lapse function there, I get some eigenvalue from the inverse metric, and then I get a sum of deformations, one along each edge that was emanating from here. This big I labels these edges. And what do I want to say here? Yeah, I have an overall 1 over delta, and it's proportional to the charge in the ith copy of U1 on the ith edge. And this deformation is along this ith edge. All right, so remember this vector field, right? It's some triad-dependent vector field. And so these things, the most natural interpretation we could think of was they ought to go along the edges of the charge network, because otherwise you don't really know where they point. OK. So the key point here is that this vertex V that was non-trivial that the H acted at is essentially moved to this new location here. And it leaves this old one trivial, right? This state right here, which this is a picture of, right? You see it has this index I, so it depends on the particular U1 copy, which comes from the vector field that I used to deform it. And it ends up shuffling these charges around and changing their signs in a particular way, right? In a way that I get from, you know, interpreting this geometrically as some finite transformation, right? So you have some particular shuffling of the charges here. And it is such that, right, so if the NJ made this deformation, then these dotted lines here are now uncharged in copy J. So that means that when this Hamiltonian acts again, when my volume or inverse Q comes here, I get zero. Right, so this is the key thing that was missing in the construction I showed you before, was that this vertex couldn't move. And so we were always getting these factors of the lapses evaluated at the same point. Now at least there's a chance that you can get derivatives.
So the Hamiltonian is state dependent.
The Hamiltonian is state dependent. Yeah, it's more state dependent than say Thomas's Hamiltonian, right?
Which depends on the graph.
Yeah, this depends on the graph, but it also depends on the charges.
So if you have a linear combination, just have first split it into a spin network, it'd be always.
Yes. Yeah, that was one of the things that we saw for diff constraint. If you don't make the operator sensitive to the group labels, then it just won't work. You have to tune it to those things too, which doesn't seem so unreasonable. I mean, if you're already tuning it to the graph, then it seems weird to not tune it to the charge labels too. Okay, and the other thing I'll point out here is that, right, this picture is a little bit exaggerated, but right, the deformation is along this edge, and all of these other edges here that meet it are kind of bunched together in this cone. They don't, the tangents aren't collinear or anything, they're just very close together. And it's this kind of a deformation that is needed if you want to have the commutator matching with the expected right-hand side, right? Basically what it does is, well, I'll say some more about what it does. Okay.
So what determines in which direction this vertex is?
Oh, you have one, okay, so it's a sum. You'll get a sum over all the edges. So I have one deformation along each edge tangent. And then this thing, okay, yeah, so it's along this edge, but it's not, I don't translate the vertex right along it, because otherwise I will get some trivial action. I need to move it off of here by some higher order and delta amount.
And so this is kind of arbitrary from
the Yes. Yeah, this is arbitrary, but it doesn't matter in the continuum. Okay, so this is a picture kind of two of them acting. At first I have this kind of singular deformation that I showed you before, and then I have another one sort of doing the same thing. Okay, so I want to take a continuum limit of the commutator after I've done some finite triangulation commutator computation. And for that, I need something like analog of Lewandowski-Morales habitat, where I have some distributions which are weighted in some way. Now, OK, so let me tell you what we did, and then I'll say how it compares. So I want to construct some set B of charged network bras based on some given charge network C with some non-trivial vertex set. And I'll say that C is in this set if it's some whole bunch of finite Hamiltonians and diffeomorphisms acting on it. All right, so I take one fixed charge net and then act on it any number of times with deformations of this type and diffeomorphisms. Okay? And then once I have constructed that set, I can form these states by just summing over all the members in that set, weighting it with this function that depends on the non-trivial vertex, which is preserved by the Hamiltonian action. If I have 5 non-trivial vertices, then the Hamiltonian action keeps 5 all the time. So this is in analogy with this Lewandowski-Morolf habitat. In their case, this set B VSA is just the set of all diffeomorphic images of a given charge network. So this looks quite complicated, but it's really the analogous thing. I'm just adding kind of Hamiltonian deformations. Okay, then the bottom line is that the continuum limit can be computed, and it's non-trivial, and it has this form. I have some square of these charges, and I have these volume eigenvalues at the first vertex, volume eigenvalues at the second vertex, because I had 2 Hamiltonians acting. And I get the correct or expected anti-symmetrized derivative of these Laplace functions along the edges and a derivative of this function. OK, so that's the left-hand side. I'll tell you briefly about the right-hand side. Everybody OK? Questions? Asleep? OK. Okay, oh yeah, so the thing I wanted to point out was that, right, I had 2 Hamiltonians acting, so I have 2 evaluations of the eigenvalue of the inverse metric here, one at one vertex and one at the other, and they're not the same in general. So this could be kind of problematic for the right-hand side where you have this, you know, composite that has both of them in here. So yeah, if I just quantize this thing naively, then I would probably get something that's kind of the square of the guy on the previous slide, but both evaluated at the same vertex, so it wouldn't match in that case. So I just want to show you this nice identity that we found to get around this. So if I consider the diffeomorphism generator smeared with one of these electric shifts, with some right now unprescribed weight alpha. And I take their Poisson bracket, 2 of them with different shifts in here. And it turns out I get the right-hand side of the, this diffeomorphism smeared with the structure function that I'm expecting times this parameter. Right, so, and this kind of naturally splits the action of D into 2 pieces, right? And those 2 pieces will kind of fix the problems that I'm talking about here by evaluating these eigenvalues at 2 different places. Yeah, so instead, we're going to quantize the right-hand side using this Poisson bracket identity. And this kind of helps give the same structure as the commutator on the left-hand side, and indeed makes it so it vanishes in continuum limit. And just to note one thing, this, if I choose alpha equal to half, which is usual density 1 case, then this just vanishes, so I can't use it. Okay, that's about all. So, yeah, all I want to show you is that this weakly coupled theory is kind of nice toy model for LQG constructions if you want to test some things. in particular dynamics. And yeah, applying these lessons learned in previous work and other toy models, right? Use kind of general framework of QSD and these Tiemann-like tricks to quantize operators. And Lewandowski-Morolf kind of generalized this idea of habitats so that I can take continuum limit in some way. And from parameterized field theory, we know that, you know, kinematically singular operators are really necessary. And from the diff constraint construction, you know, it was really helpful to have this geometric interpretation of the action of the constraint in order to motivate what you're going to do at finite triangulation. So all these things help lead to an off-shell representation of this hypersurface deformation algebra, at least in this matrix element sense. Okay, so in future, you know, we would like to see what I call a habitat-based calculation, where I'm not just looking at matrix elements, where you can actually, you know, if I take the continuum limit of some operator using a habitat state, if I can recognize that that gives me some other habitat state that I can identify, then that's kind of a stronger statement, and that's what happens for the diff constraint, right? You do this finite triangulation computation and take limits, and the thing that you get is the same as the matrix element between another Lewandowski-Morolf state where the function that labels it has been differentiated. Right, so you can define those operators directly on these distributional spaces. So you have a real representation of that without having to worry about the kinematical Hilbert space. It'd be nice to study this U1 theory more just in classical situation. And if you could get a handle on that, then right, it's Molin's original idea as QG and power series. But as Bianca tells me, it's too hard.
I found it too hard.
Yeah, so we could use it to look at observables, which is another open question in LQG or in gravity in general. Yeah, Smolin has two observables in his paper on this, so that's a start. And if you have more, sorry?
What's the interpretation of them? Is there any?
Oh, yeah, I don't know. It's just like integral of E dot A over the whole space, something.
It's kind of
Without time derivative, not time derivative. That's not what I mean by dot. Just
E-A-I
times A,
A-I. Okay.
And then, in future, hopefully go to, you know, use some of these ideas in SU2, try and get some geometric interpretation in SU2, or maybe at least think of ways that it's possible to act on spin networks that leave some vertices trivial or something, or actually move vertices. Is there some way to do that? That's all. Thank you. Yes.
So that doesn't matter anymore at all in the new after you trivialize it, in a sense.
That's correct. Well, I mean, it doesn't get acted on again. I mean, there's still a vertex there, and it's still charged, but it's not charged in all the copies.
And then you move, so you move the vertex, the new vertex is moved around in three space.
Yes.
Do some spin label change.
Yes. I thought it wouldn't take too much time to go into, but right from this, from the action of the Hamiltonian vector field on A, you get this Lie derivative looking thing, and then when you translate it into some finite action, it's naturally interpreted as, you know, dragging the 2 copy of the edge in some direction and recoloring it with, you know, the 3 charge or something. You have some charge flipping and sign changing that is determined by that the classical action.
So if you look at it in the diff invariant Hilbert space, would I claim it's really non-graph changing? Because
no, it is graph changing. I mean, you have a no, strictly speaking, you have a new vertex.
Yeah,
but it's just that as far as
not that anymore. So
yeah, okay.
So in a sense, it's basic question whether we can just ignore this old one and see that as a,
yeah,
that's the topology of this. If you know the old vertex, that's the topology of the graph change at all?
No.
So maybe one could see that as non-graph changing.
Maybe what?
Maybe one could see that as non-graph changing in a sense.
If you interpret it in this way, then yes. But strictly speaking, you still have, I mean, it's a different graph. It's not like the old edges are uncharged. They're charged in 2 of the 3 copies.
Okay, so they're which is a bit harder to do in SE2.
Right. Yeah, I'm not sure I know it. Yeah, who knows what that means.
More questions? Okay, then let's thank our speaker again. Maybe we will have some more questions.